Under pressure. If the projector doesn't work, it's going to be my fault. So, and Candy would be the first to say yes. But anyway, this morning, of course, is, I think everybody here knows, is Easter Sunday. This is a time of year when people around the nation and people around the world take out special time to remember Good Friday, this last Friday, to commemorate his death. And then, as you know, Easter commemorates Christ's resurrection. And some would say we really, as Christians, commemorate these events every week. And that is true. As we gather around the Lord's Supper, often, you know, on Sunday, we remember his death, we proclaim his death until he comes again. And the reason that Christians met on the first day of the week rather than the Sabbath, the seventh day of the week, the reason they met on the first day of the week is because it was Resurrection Day. So the fact that we come together every first day of the week kind of recognizes that this is a special day because this was the day of the week that Jesus was risen from the dead. Nevertheless, I don't think it's a bad thing that one time of year, that particularly in Western nations and in many nations throughout the world, that we give special attention to Christ's death and resurrection. Nothing is much more, you could put his incarnation along with it, but other than the incarnation, nothing is more central to our faith than these events that we celebrate this week. This morning, even though I read from Isaiah chapter 53, I will admit that the sermon does have more to do with the resurrection. It wasn't necessarily intended that way at the beginning, but as it went on, that's kind of the way I went. But this morning, I want to talk about two views of life. The first one is what I think is the dominant one today in our culture and in our world. And that view says that life is primarily about this world and this life that we're living in the here and now. And people don't necessarily exactly come out and say that or word it that way, but it's seen in the way that we live our lives. I think the culture that we live in today is by and large not worried about death. We tend to be more this world focused. And I think there's some reasons for that. I think modern medicine has an impact. We have longer life expectancy than ever before. We have in many countries throughout the world, not only in America, but you know, relative prosperity and wealth. And I think those all factor into this idea that people today, as much as any time in history, are this world focused. And yet, as I look at scriptures from the Bible, I realize that this is nothing new. John says in 1 John, "Do not love the world or the things in the world, for the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of the life are not of the Father, but of the world." And it talks about, but this world and the form of this world is passing away. Or Jesus said, "What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his life?" That apparently that we're reminded that even in Jesus' time and the disciples' time, there was still a tendency, even in that day and time, to be worldly focused, to focus on the here and now. They had shorter lifespans. There were many more that died in childbirth. And you'd think that in the ancient world that they'd be focused more on spiritual things. But as we see in New Testament and some of the teachings of the New Testament, that was oftentimes not the case. But nevertheless, I do think that it's, you know, that this is compounded by the situation in the world today. By longer life expectancy, by the comparative prosperity that you see in the world today, there's a tendency, I think, more now more than ever to be this worldly focused. And I was thinking of another side of this, and I was first going to say it's ironic, but maybe it's not. But one of the things I think you see in our society today is that people are not good at dealing with death and mortality. There is a famous psychiatrist by the name of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross that talked about how previous generations were better at dealing with death than our own. Previous generations oftentimes viewed death as part of life. She wrote a book called On Death and Dying. And she made some observances in that book that became very popular. If you've ever heard of the five stages of grief, those five stages of grief come from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's On Death and Dying. She is the one that kind of originated that idea of the five stages of grief. But near the beginning of the book, as she's talking about death and dying, On Death and Dying, she talks about a death that she witnessed in her childhood in her native Switzerland, where she was born and raised. And she tells a story of a man who was allowed to die at home. Family and friends came by the house to give their goodbyes. That children were not excluded from those events. There was no embalming, no fake makeup, no pretend sleep. That death was viewed as a natural end to life in this world. And she contrasted that to modern America, where she spent most of her adult life. I believe she passed away in 2004. But where she said death is viewed as taboo. Discussion of death or mortality is regarded as morbid. When someone dies, children are often sent away with the thought that it would be too much for them. And consequently, children don't learn to deal with the reality of death. And I would go on to say, and these are my words, not her, that death is oftentimes almost viewed, it seems like, in the world today as an exception to the rule. Although we have sayings like, you know, the two things you can't avoid or things like death and taxes. But I remember in Archer City, one of our members' sons got sick with cancer. And when I say one of our members and it being her son, now you got to keep in mind, she lived until she was 100 years old. So she was, you know, the son wasn't really young, but she was a little older than him, obviously, being the mother. But anyway, but one of her sons, you know, member sons, his name was Carl Kinsey, got cancer. And he was in his 60s at the time. And it was the second time he had cancer. And I remember I was over visiting with the family, and one of his son-in-law said, you know, he beat it once before, he can do it again. And it was true, he had beat it once before. But I thought what was interesting is the language. That death is something to beat. It's something that we can defeat. When we all know that unless Christ comes again in our lifetime, we won't avoid death. Now, I will say about Carl Kinsey, he died with dignity. He died surrounded by family. I had the honor of doing his funeral, and I really had a chance to get and know some of his family. But I think back again to that wording, and you know, maybe he could have beat it a second time. In his case, he didn't. But even if he did, the fact remains that our life on this earth is temporary. From the 1500s to about 1800, life expectancy throughout Europe hovered between 30 and 40 years of age. Today, in most industrialized countries, they have life expectancy oftentimes of more than 75 years of age. But whether it's 75 or 80 or 90 or 100 years, the fact remains that our life on this earth is temporary. And so in all, kind of two things stand out to me about modern culture's view of life, and I think they really go hand in hand. On one hand, we're really this worldly focused. And when I say we, I mean culture at large. I'm not talking about us individually. I'm not talking necessarily about the people here at church. But one, I think we are worldly focused. And number two, which I think is maybe a consequence of that, we're not good at dealing and facing death and dying. And again, I think these two go hand in hand, because if we are this worldly focused, if we're focused on our life in this world, then we're not going to be good at dealing with the end of life and our mortality. But anyway, the first view I wanted to talk about this morning is the view that says that this world is all that there is. This world is where it is at. The second view I want to talk about this morning says that we are made for another world. Or the way some may word it is to say that we are made for eternity. And central to Jesus' teaching is this idea that we are in fact made for eternity. He tells the Jews of his day, when you pray, don't stand and pray in the synagogues or on the street corners to be seen by others. He says, if you do, you've already received your reward. But he says, go and pray in secret. And then your Father who sees what you do in secret will, and I think that's an important word, will reward you. It's future tense. He will reward you. He tells us not to store up treasures on earth where moth and rust consume and thieves break in and steal, but to give alms, to give to the poor and store up treasure in heaven where neither moth or rust can consume and where thieves cannot break in and steal. He says not to fear the ones who can destroy the body but cannot do anything to the soul. But he says, rather fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. He says, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? He says, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Amen. In the parable of the rich fool, he talks about this man who's building larger barns to store up his goods so he can finally say to himself, he can basically what we call retire today. He can say, let me eat, drink, and be merry. I've got goods stored up for the future. And what is Jesus' response? He says, you fool, this very night your life is taken from you. Or one of my favorite is the story of the rich man and Lazarus. I call it the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. Some get into this debate on whether or not it's a parable. I don't really see what it matters. I've never taken it completely literally. When pious Jews die, do they really go to Abraham's side? Somehow I've always taken that more figurative. But regardless of how you view it, whether you view it historically or if you view it as more of a parable like I do, regardless, what makes all the difference is what happens when they die. You know, it doesn't matter how great the rich man's life was here on this earth, that he feasted sumptuously every day. He doesn't care after he dies. And it doesn't matter how hard Lazarus' life was in this world. All that matters is what's happening to them once they die. And you see this in the rich man. He wants a chance to go back and to warn his brothers, because he suddenly realizes what really matters. Because what is really important is what happens in the afterlife. And you might be asking, you know, as I talk about these two views of life this morning, you might be asking, what does all of this have to do with the resurrection? Well, I think it has everything to do with the resurrection. If Jesus really rose from the dead, then it shows us that the end of this life, that death is not the end. And if death is not the end, then what really matters is precisely what happens when this life is over. And what matters in this life is not how much wealth we have. What matters is not what kind of house we live in or what kind of car we drive. It's not what kind of food we have to eat or how much we have to eat. It's not what kind of clothes we have to wear. It doesn't matter what degrees we have or what kind of trophies we have in our closet. The only thing that really matters is what kind of people we are becoming. And are we becoming the kind of people that are made for another world? We as Christians believe that He was raised, and we believe that He is coming back. And if He is coming back, He is coming back to judge the living and the dead. I think it's interesting, and I could have picked many sermons in the book of Acts, but I decided to choose the one from Mars Hill. But of course, if you know Mars Hill is in Athens. And of course, Athens is famous, you know, for its philosophers and the ancient Greeks, and it was well known for its philosophy even in the first century, even though, you know, Plato had long since passed away, and it's been, you know, centuries since Plato. But Paul ends his sermon there on Mars Hill in verse 31. He says, because God has fixed a day on which He will have the world judged in righteousness by a man whom He has appointed, and of this He has given assurance to all by raising Him from the dead. That Jesus was raised from the dead, He ascended into heaven, He is coming back, and there is going to be a final judgment, is part of what the story of the resurrection means for us. The resurrection of Jesus is an affirmation of all His teaching, that what matters is not primarily what happens in the here and now in this life, but what matters is what kind of men and women we are becoming and whether we are a people that are made for another world. Now, I do want to treat or to deal with one common misconception of what I'm saying. And that misconception has been worded different ways. It's that we believe that the belief in an afterlife is basically pie in the sky. Or as Karl Marx, the communist, would say, he called religion the opium of the people. And that's the idea that being focused on eternity makes us less useful and kind of escaping from the realities of this world. And I think that view is completely wrong, because you cannot divorce spirituality from ethics in Christianity. You cannot separate spirituality from character formation. You could possibly do that in many pagan religions of ancient times, and some of the so-called mystery religions that were common in the first century in the Roman Empire, and maybe in many religions that are out there in the world today, but you cannot do that with Christianity. If you turn open to the New Testament, you only have to read as far as Matthew chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount, to see that spirituality and ethics, how we live in this world, go hand in hand. Or Paul says at the end of Titus chapter 2 that Christ died to purify a people of his own zealous for good deeds. You know, we as Christians don't escape from this world. We as Christians are the people who are called to stop and help the wounded traveler in need, to be the good Samaritan. We are a people that are supposed to take compassion on those in need. We are supposed to visit the sick, help the oppressed, be kind and honest and generous to all. We are a people called to try to be faithful and loyal husbands and to be faithful and loyal wives. We try to raise up our kids the best we can because we really love them and care about them. We try to be a people who are going to build other people up rather than tear other people down. You know, I actually think the world we live in would be a whole lot better place if there were more sincere Christians really trying to put Christianity into practice in their life. For one thing, if you take a more secular worldview, a worldview that says that this world is all that there is, there's a tendency when you're trying to make the most of this world, there's a tendency to be very self-focused, to be more selfish, to become concerned with your own happiness and your own welfare. Whereas if you believe we are made for eternity and you believe the teachings of Christianity, you are going to try to become a person that is more selfless, who seeks, number one, to love God, and number two, to love your neighbor as yourself. That as Christians, we are called in the Scriptures to be a people who put our focus on helping others and growing in Christian virtues and actions. In all, my point is that Christianity or belief in the afterlife is not escapism. It makes a difference how we live in the here and now. If we live sincere Christian lives, it will make a difference in what kind of people we are in the present world. On Friday, many people reflected on Good Friday, the day that Jesus laid down his life for our sins. And many people today, including ourselves, reflect on his resurrection. And we believe that Jesus rose from the dead, he ascended into heaven, and he is coming back one day to judge the living and the dead. The first funeral I ever did was actually one of my grandparents, my mom's mother, my grandmother. And she was a faithful Christian, so in that sense it was good. It made it a whole lot easier. And I was only 24 years old when I preached her funeral. I was only a few weeks out of preaching school, and actually the last time I ever saw her, she came to my graduation a few weeks earlier. But I remember that day that I did her funeral, and really every time ever since, that I've always thought that funerals give us a perspective of what really matters in life. You know, when you're burying a loved one, you're not worried about how big of a house you live in or how much money you have and stuff like that. Your only regrets are things that you could have done or maybe ways you could have helped and that sort of thing. It makes you realize what's really important. It's what kind of people we are. Whether we really are devoted to God, whether we really love other people, how we treat other people and things like that. It becomes real clear to me anyway when I go to a funeral or take part in a funeral what really matters in this life. And it's not the things that too many people and too often myself spend too much time focusing on. It's spiritual things. It's character things. It's what kind of people that we are. And I think death puts all of that into perspective. We are mortal. Our lives in this world are temporary. And maybe for some that is bad news. But the good news is that we are also made for eternity. That Jesus rose again, and He is coming back to judge the living and the dead. So what really matters is that we are a people who prepare for that day. Amen. If anyone needs to come this morning, we invite you to come while together we stand and we sing.
King of my life, I crown thee now.